as well as the noon and the afternoon prayer. But what about Maghrib or dusk prayer, as well as the Isha ones?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Maghrib prayer begins when redness, you know, mm-hmm. after sunset,
yes.
appears in the sky. After sunset, there is a red cloud, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not cloud, but it is like thin.
Like a fog.
Yeah, fog. But it's red in color. It appears, you know, and it comes up. And when it disappears, that redness disappears, that is the time when you should start offering prayer. And that's the time for Maghrib prayer,
uh-huh.
you know. And that's the beginning point, but the time for Maghrib and Isha prayers, of course, continues until midnight.
Both of them?
Yeah. Of course, when it comes to this, the time specific to Maghrib, of course, you have 3 minutes or 2 minutes to offer Maghrib prayer. And in that time, you can never offer the Isha prayer because that is the time specific or exclusive for the for Maghrib prayer. And also, Isha also has its specific time, and in that time you cannot offer Maghrib prayer. So, but the time between the Maghrib and the Isha, of course, the time in between is the time common between those two prayers.
Sheikh, the kind of question that I want to ask you right now might also be applied to the noon prayer and the afternoon prayer. But since we are talking about the Maghrib and Isha prayers,
yes.
You said a couple of minutes, like 2-3 minutes. But don't you think it's relative to a person, in fact, offering the prayer? Because one might, in fact, offer the prayer, like, for example, Maghrib prayer, as an example, like in 2 minutes, but another person in 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, as soon as you offer your prayer, no matter how quick or how slow you offer,
uh-huh.
you know, it's up to you.
Uh-huh.
Because for some people, it takes time to
yes.
offer Maghrib prayer, and they may offer their prayers in 5 minutes.
Right.
But there are some people who offer a quickie prayer.
Yes.
Like they just give 1 minute and the prayer is over. Some people are able to offer their prayers very quickly in just 1 hour, 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as they finish the prayer, then it's time for the next prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And so the time varies from one person to another person. And aged people, of course, may need more time to offer
mm-hmm.
a 4-rakat prayer than younger ones.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always recommended that one should one offer his prayer slowly, carefully, and with full concentration. It's not good to hasten in offering prayers. And it's always recommended that one should focus and make sure that he understands what he's saying. You know,
mm-hmm.
every word is spoken to God.
Yes.
You know, we are speaking to God, and we should understand what we are talking. So it's very important to concentrate.
Yes,
during
exactly.
prayers.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be back discussing and continuing to discuss more about the rules of prayer. Stay with us.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker in the studio, talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh, you were talking about, in fact, the time for the daily prayers. But if regarding this question, if for one person, for any kind of reason, may not be able to offer his or her Maghrib prayer or fails to do so, right?
Yeah.
Well, until midnight probably. Can they offer it any time after midnight?
Of course, you know, Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that if for some excuse, you know, like, for example, he was actually unable to offer the Maghrib and Isha prayers in time, he was very busy, he was very much preoccupied, and he could not make time to offer those prayers for some very good reasons, okay?
Yes.
So in that case, not only Supreme Leader, but also the religious, other religious authorities have said that that individual, in fact, should offer those prayers not with the niyyah of adha or qadha, but actually he should offer them as mafid dhimma. Okay, mafid dhimma, it is an intention, meaning that one should offer his prayers as something which is supposed to be offered by him, which is obligatory on him, but it's not clear whether it is obligatory or whether it's adha or qadha, whether it is a offered, which is a prayer offered in time, within the prescribed time, or out of the prescribed time. Okay, so that's why it is the word mafid dhimma has to be understood, because mafid dhimma means something which is
incumbent on us,
incumbent upon us.
Yes.
So that is what we mean by mafid dhimma. So the intention when a person is offering a delayed prayer, a prayer after the prescribed time, he should not make any niyyah of adha or qadha. He should offer that prayer, or those prayers, in fact, with the niyyah that it is incumbent, however, upon him. And in that case, he will be relieved of the obligation to pray.
What about the Isha prayer?
The same is the case with Isha, of course. Yes. He should offer it before the Adhan for Fajr prayer. But if the time for Fajr prayer sets in, then of course the prayer, those prayers, Isha and Maghrib prayer, Maghrib and Isha prayers, they become qadha. They become qadha.
Like any normal daily prayer, like the noon prayer or afternoon prayer, or even the morning prayer.
Sure.
I see. Okay. We have time actually for a very quick question. Which is better, Sheikh, prayer on time or delaying the prayers and offering them in congregation?
Well, we know and we do understand that it's very important to offer our prayers in the earliest portion of the time prescribed for prayer. But at the same time, we know that Jama'ah prayer is very, you know, very important. And there is tremendous reward in offering one's prayers in a congregation. Now, when it comes to which one is better, offering your prayers in the early part of the time or offering your prayers with Jama'ah, with in the congregational prayer, of course, the religious authorities have said that it's better to delay your prayer so as to join a Jama'ah prayer and attend a congregational prayer and offer your prayers in congregation, because there's more reward, there is more significance, and it's more virtuous.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun mannanun. La ilaha illa hum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun salimun basirun.
Monarchy is by definition incompatible with democracy. You cannot have a government chosen by election and at the same time have individuals occupying positions of power simply because they were born the sons or daughters of families who already have political power. It was on this principle that the English people fought a civil war, made a revolution, and cut off their king's head in the 17th century. When, after 10 years of being one of the first republics in the world, a monarch was restored to the British throne, it came to be understood that no king or queen would ever seek to rule without Parliament. Indeed, as Britain became a democracy, supporters of the parliamentary system insisted that the British monarchy has no real political power. The Victorian political theorist Walter Bagehot, for instance, wrote that the monarchy was merely a decorative part of the constitution and that real power was exercised by the cabinet. But even now, in the 21st century, is this really true? The royal family is, apart from anything else and beyond dispute, very wealthy, and money is one sort of power. And we pay for the royal family to remain wealthy. Their cost to the taxpayer has been estimated to anywhere between £40 million and £200 million. More than this, recent reports have revealed how much the royal family routinely seeks to directly and personally change the decisions of government. Here we look at how the hereditary power of the royal family still has an impact on the course of British political life.
The power behind the throne. Part 2.
BAE Systems, Britain's leading arms manufacturer, recently sold 72 Typhoon fighter jets to the Saudi Arabian dictatorship. The original offer from the Saudis was £4.4 billion. But when the deal was done, Ian King, BAE's chief executive, said the public was never going to know how much money the company was eventually paid. But one thing we do know is that on the very eve of the day that the deal was signed, Prince Charles was one of the Saudis' guests in the capital, Riyadh, dressed in the traditional robes and joining the Saudi princes in a sword dance.
Well, the deal with Saudi Arabia was for 72 Eurofighter jets, which are made by BAE Systems. And the deal was worth £4.4 billion to BAE Systems, and funnily enough was signed the day before the otherwise disappointing results for 2013 were released, and while Prince Charles was in Saudi Arabia wining and dining with the heads of the regime who they were pursuing to get the final cost. I'd make the point that David Cameron had visited Saudi Arabia himself in November last year trying to cement this deal, and David Cameron had failed to do it. So it looks an awful lot like Prince Charles went over and did BAE's dirty work for them.
Prince Charles has been, by his own admission, a kind of mascot for the British arms trade, so much so that even he has complained about being used to market weapons in his perhaps more sober moments. But this is still a man who, this is his job, and you can see here where it's a job that's been done, as a role that the royal family always carry out, regardless of, you know, whether they have a sort of momentary crisis of conscience or whatever. But it remains the case that up until very recent years and months, the royal family, and Prince Charles in particular, have been responsible for closing very big arms deals, particularly with Saudi Arabia. This is another monarchy which can probably does actually beat the royal family in terms of its just reactionary nature. This is a regime that regularly decapitates people for adultery and witchcraft and drug use and anything you can name, really. So this is a thoroughly reactionary and state, and one that has committed crimes against humanity, that the British monarchy have rubber stamped these kinds of sales.
The palace denied that the princes, Saudi and British, discussed the arms deal.
One of the key questions is, why do the Saudi Arabian government or the Bahraini regime or any others want to have Prince Charles or Prince Andrew go over to their country and shake hands and greet and be taken around tourist sites. And the reason is because it gives them legitimacy. It gives a British endorsement. What it says is that not just is the United Kingdom prepared to do business with you, we are prepared to send over one of the heads of state to go over and do our bidding. And what it says is that Prince Charles is being used by BAE Systems and is being used as an arms dealer.
A previous investigation into UK-Saudi arms deals, Margaret Thatcher's sale of Tornado aircraft in the Al Yamamah deal, was blocked by Tony Blair on national security grounds.
Prince Andrew's done more than his fair share of whining and dining with some of the most repressive regimes and dictators in the world. Earlier this year, Prince Andrew was in Bahrain as part of Great British Week, where he went over with some of the great British companies, companies like BAE Systems and other arms companies, Rolls-Royce, who were there specifically to sell weapons and to make deals with some of the most repressive governments in the world.
There is a direct relationship between what the royal family are doing in relation to arms sales and in relation to imperial wars, let it be said, because, of course, members of the royal family serve in the armed forces, and by serving in the armed forces, Harry in Afghanistan, for example, what they do is they put a kind of gloss on those kinds of imperial interventions. So the royal family is involved in the imperialist wars in that sense, is giving its blessing to those imperialist wars, and selling arms to Saudi Arabia is selling arms to an extremely reactionary monarchy with an appalling human rights record, an appalling record on civil liberties, which is also using its military power, projecting its military power elsewhere to suppress revolutionary movements in Bahrain 2 or 3 years ago and currently in Yemen.
Former South African MP Andrew Feinstein resigned in protest over BAE bribery allegations. He has his own experience of the royal family's arms interests.
We try to investigate a huge and very corrupt arms deal. BAE won the contract in very controversial circumstances. The plane that the Air Force wanted was 2.5 times less expensive than the BAE offering and was far more suited to South Africa's needs. But the Metropolitan Police have estimated that £115 million in bribes were paid on that one deal alone. And unfortunately, the British royal family were intimately involved, together with Tony Blair, the then Prime Minister, in persuading the new South African government to buy these trainers and jet fighters, to the extent that the then Royal Yacht Britannia was sailed to Cape Town Harbour with some members of the royal family aboard, and they invited to dinner those ministers who were going to make the crucial decision about BAE Systems.
Strangely, perhaps, a Buckingham Palace spokesman who spoke to The Guardian had much the same view, with an added tinge of colonial snobbery. Middle East potentates like meeting princes. He comes in as the son of the Queen, and that opens doors that otherwise would remain closed. He can raise problems with the Crown Prince, and 4 or 5 weeks later, we discover that the difficulties have been overcome and the contract can be signed. He brings an immeasurable value in smoothing the path for British companies. We don't send him to developed countries like France and Sweden, where a member of the royal family would not make a difference. But in developing countries or the Far East, a prince can get in because of who he is.
One of the characteristics of British capitalism, the British economy in recent times, really I suppose since the Second World War, has been that the arms industry has played a very important role in the British economy and in British trade. The British are very keen to sell top-of-the-range weapons technology. Very often the market is dictators, particularly dictators in the Middle East and North Africa. And if you want to establish diplomatic relations and trading relations with feudal or semi-feudal regimes in the Middle East and North Africa. It helps if you've got your own royals who can operate at that social level, who can give you an entree. So Prince Charles has played a major role. Prince Andrew has played a major role. Other royals, I'm sure, as well, have played a role in developing these diplomatic relations and helping arms manufacturers to sell weapons to Middle Eastern dictators.
Unlike the case of Prince Andrew, when there have been other members of royal families in other parts of the world who have got involved, for instance, in the arms trade and behaved inappropriately, they suffer consequences. For instance, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands at one point was promoting arms sales into the Netherlands and was working with two American companies to do so. Neither of the companies realized he was working for the other, and his wife, the Queen of the Netherlands, didn't know he was working for either of them. When it was discovered that he was engaged in this activity, he was stripped of all sorts of rights and privileges, and he was never allowed to wear the uniform of the Dutch military ever again. Now, having a royal family is not ideal, but if one has one for whatever historical reasons, at least make them accountable and answerable for their actions, whereas in this country they can effectively do as they like.
But Andrew's particular form of charm worked as well on dictators whether or not they were of the royal variety. He is reported to have had a close friendship with Saif Gaddafi, son of Colonel Gaddafi, and hosted a lunch at Buckingham Palace for the son-in-law of Tunisian dictator Ben Ali, despite being warned of his corrupt activities by the British Embassy in Tunis. As for the Saudi government, the biggest market for UK arms companies, they are now using those arms in an unprovoked attack on neighbouring Yemen. In the world of international diplomacy, it is usual to distinguish between a nation's hard power and its soft power. The hard power of the US, for instance, is its military capacity and its economic strength. Its soft power might be the cultural influence of Hollywood, the social influence of its press, or the good feeling felt by millions of children around the globe towards Ronald McDonald or Captain America.
The soft power of the UK is considered to be a persuasive approach using cultural and economic means, whereas the UK hard power would be considered to be military might, aggression, war or policing.
So it is with the British monarchy. Part of its power, as we have seen, is its hard power, the power of wealth, of landed property, of direct political influence. But perhaps it has even greater influence in its exercise of soft power, the ideological and cultural influence that the royal family exerts in British society.
Well, I think in terms of the soft and hard power, so to speak, of the royal family, there are there's a clear backstop to everything that happens in British democratic life. They do sanction any political party that comes into power. In fact, in the 1970s, they overturned the election of a progressive prime minister in Australia because it went so far against the interests of the royal family. So they actually do have the power to overturn governments. These things are very rarely used because to do that does actually draw into public awareness the actual power the monarchy has. Like the Black Spider memos, we're told that actually no, they're just a kind of, you know, they're just the icing on the cake. They're just a kind of tourist attraction. They're just, you know, symbolic figureheads and so on. But actually, with the Black Spider memos, you find out no, they're actually interfering in daily life on a regular basis. Around the Scottish independence campaign, you see that they're actually interfering in the democratic processes going on inside Britain. So there's always the kind of a dance between their soft and their hard power. So when they use it, when they bring out the big guns, they actually expose themselves. So they're very careful. The British ruling class is very careful about where they step in and where they don't step in.
It's very difficult to actually tell what power and influence the monarchy has over this government because it's so secret. It's like the rest of the corporate lobbying industry in this country is all done behind closed doors, or as David Cameron likes to say, it's a quiet word. You know, we don't know who's speaking to whom, we don't know who's having a quiet word with whom about which policies. So I see it as actually the tip of a very large iceberg. We have a £2 billion industry that we know nothing about, and the royalty are part of that. I mean, they're exceptional because they have this kind of magic sheen around them, which is the pomp and the costumes and the dressing up that they do. And so we don't sort of question their influence as much as we should. But we should look at really who out of everybody. I mean, we should look at the whole industry. And they are lobbyists. They have private commercial interests.
The royal family is quite deliberately used by the British establishment as a traditional symbol of the hierarchical and elitist society as a whole.
The media collaborates in the cover-up. It collaborates in massaging the news in order to downplay anything which is critical of the royal family. And what it also does is it pumps up all of the kind of bread and circuses nonsense, the Hello magazine-type celebrity culture, which surrounds them. So there's a royal wedding or there's a royal baby or whatever, and they turn it into a jamboree, which is like something out of ancient Rome or something out of medieval England. A completely kind of feudal sort of obsession with these extraordinarily rich.
After all, if people in Britain can be got to accept one incredibly wealthy individual whose position as nominal head of state and church and chief of the armed forces is hereditary, then why should they not accept an entire ruling elite based on similarly undemocratic principles? The existence of the monarchy is based on the idea of perpetual inequality as a natural order. It bolsters the old adages that seek to ensure that the status quo remains undisturbed. This is the world where the poor are always with us, where there will always be the rich man in his castle and the poor man at his gate.
If the purpose of the monarchy is as a tourist attraction, we should do two things. We should add a small levy onto the taxes and fees the tourists pay to come into the UK anyway. And that's how we could fund the British monarchy, rather than it being funded through hard-earned taxpayers' pounds and pence. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if what they're meant to be is a tourist attraction, then they should stay well out of any public debates, that constitutionally they shouldn't be involved in any way. So Prince Andrew should not be rushing around the world like a buffoon, selling British weapons to highly inappropriate governments. Prince Charles should not be writing letters to people in decision-making positions to try and ensure that his vision of what the United Kingdom should look like architecturally is imposed on the country. Then they can be just a tourist attraction. Then I would have less of a problem with them. But as long as we are paying for their extremely luxurious lifestyle, I think we also have a right to determine what they do and don't do.
This is a world where the poor and disadvantaged are supposed to find solace in gazing on the finery of the royals, where everything from the crown jewels to Kate Middleton's wedding dress is supposed to bring glamour to lives where even small luxuries cost a week's wages. The majority of the press encourage us to forget our own troubles and worry about the happiness or otherwise of the characters in the royal soap opera. William and Kate's happy marriage, Diana and Charles's unhappy marriage, are talked about as if they matter more than the trials and joys of our own friends and relatives.
They have a very sophisticated PR machine. They are a brand that needs to be looked after, and they engage in any other practices that any other entity brand engages in. So any bad stories they will seek to quash and keep out of the media, and they will pump it full of good stories.
The unacceptable racist ramblings of the Duke of Edinburgh are suppressed. The unfortunate nonsense let slip by Prince Andrew is excused. The less appealing members of the family, like Fergie, are hidden from view or expelled from the clan.
And it is worth remembering that this is not a family who've exactly covered themselves in glory by the way they've behaved. I mean, Prince Andrew's father, the Duke of Edinburgh, has on numerous occasions been overheard making quite racist comments, highly inappropriate comments. I mean, one of the younger members of the royal family, Prince Harry, found it amusing to dress up in a Nazi uniform for a fancy dress party.
Every charitable gesture or good work, on the other hand, is magnified. It is the work of PR experts, spin doctors, and the loyal royal correspondents. But it is a national myth, and only partly believed.
The royal family is of course, packaged as a family of people who are doing all sorts of good works, who are raising money for charity and that kind of thing. And of course, that's all part of the packaging. It's a necessary part of the packaging. The reality is quite different. The reality is that they are a central institution in a very conservative and traditional political order. But they are also, despite the fact they are in a sense a leftover from feudalism, they're also doing the business of modern British capitalism.
The UK would be far better off without a monarchy, just in terms of monetary value. The £45 billion that they're worth could be redistributed to a whole host of good causes, social workers, firefighters, the homeless, etc., etc. In this time of austerity, supposedly there's a 600% rise in food banks. Why doesn't the Queen or the monarchy just distribute one of their palaces, one of their castles to that? There's people going hungry in this country, and I don't see the Queen participating in the austerity movement. And we'd have a more democratic country. We as people would no longer be subjects, we'd be citizens. And finally, just to add one more thing, it's still technically illegal to discuss republicanism as an alternative to monarchy. That's something that needs to be repealed in Parliament immediately if we're to be taken seriously as a democratic country.
Despite the years of pro-royal propaganda, some 30% think the UK would be better off without a monarch. That figure rises to 50% in Scotland. Some 60% are against Prince Charles becoming king when the current Queen dies.
The easiest question to answer is, would the UK be better off without the royal family? Yes, it would. And of course, it wouldn't be the UK. It wouldn't be a united kingdom. It would be a democratic country. In fact, it would be much smaller in an ideal world. It wouldn't encroach into any of the landmass of Ireland. It wouldn't encroach even into Scotland. That's clearly said. Over 50% now actually want to separate. Most people, over 60%, admit it's inevitable that there will be a separation. This can only be a good thing, because this sort of bundle of different small countries in a small part of the European landmass, or just off the European landmass, have had exponential, disproportionate and destructive range over the entire planet for centuries, and I think for that to come to an end can only be a good thing, really.
There is no question at all that Britain would be a much healthier place without the monarchy. But the monarchy is only one of a number of antiquated institutions which are barriers to real democracy. The House of Lords is another. Our dysfunctional electoral system, our first-past-the-post system, is a third. And there are many others that one could think of. The British political system needs a radical overhaul, even to create a modern parliamentary democracy. And we need to see very, very radical changes indeed in the way in which we make decisions if the interests of ordinary people are going to be reflected going forwards.
There is likely to be a crisis of confidence, if not a constitutional crisis, when the Queen is succeeded by Charles. It will be a moment when ordinary citizens in the UK have to examine whether an hereditary, hugely wealthy, unconstitutionally influential, politically reactionary institution is still the best adornment for a supposedly democratic society in the 21st century.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Still in the area of discussing our social relationships with others, and one of the most important topics I think that is in this part of this very important book is social justice. And when we do speak about social justice, we're not only talking about defending the oppressed, we're not talking only about making reform and demanding change, but we're also talking about keeping that level of social cohesion, about the importance of building a society that is based on respect, mutual respect, on honoring one another, on keeping the level of peace between one another. And I think that's a very, very important thing. And that really needs a lot of skills as well. Because one of the things that probably we might think comes to our mind when this topic does come up is, well, we're talking about defending the oppressed and being against the oppressor. But that's only one application of, you know, this level of al-adala al-ijtima'iyya or social justice. And maybe there are always going to be cases where we will have difference of opinion, difference in ideology, difference in belief. But at least we are able to religiously coexist. We are able to theologically coexist. And I do believe that's a very important thing, especially with, in the case of, you know, Muslims living in the West, where, you know, we are away from a Islamic society or a Muslim society, and we might be a very small minority, and therefore there might be a lot of pressure, especially in today's world where Islam really is the most misunderstood religion around. So it makes things even more difficult. And all the other challenging kind of problems that we face, as far as in some places, discrimination, persecution, misunderstanding, misrepresentation, and of course, the noisy voice will always be the loudest. You know, the one who makes the more problems, the one who makes the more noise, the one who shakes the boat the most, you know, will of course make more waves, as they say. So that's why, you know, when you do talk about Islam or Muslims, the first thing that might come to some people's mind is the radicals and the terrorists and all these other issues and problems. I think this introduction leads me to talk about how important this particular topic is, al-islah dhat al-bayn, or reconciling between two people.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرون دماغ و ثواب داره فرون رضوان
است. One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درختکاری رو کم ثواب داره. دعا هم داره، ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دیگه اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Reconciling between two people. A group of people doesn't necessarily need to be two people, but, you know, between individuals and al-islah or reconciling, finding ways to bring back the ties together between individuals is not only a very important social recommendation, but it is also something highly recommended in Islam as well, on a shar'i level, as far as it being a very important act of ibadah itself. And that's why we can see that in the Holy Quran there are numerous verses that speak about reconciling, that speak about mending the ties between people, and about us as third parties being involved in that procedure as well. And I think that's a very, very important thing here also, where in one verse, for example, it says, فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهُ وَأَصْلِحُوا ذَاتَ بَيْنَكُمْ. And fear Allah, be wary of God's existence, be wary of God and reform or fix or mend or reconcile between you. There's an interesting verse that I would like to share as well, but just before that there's another ayah, where in Surah Al-Hujurat, verse number 10, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, إِنَّمَا الْمُؤْمِنُونَ إِخْوَى فَأَصْلِحُوا بَيْنَ أَخَوَيْكُمْ. Indeed, the believers are brethren, so reconcile between the brethren. We've already mentioned this before, so there's no need for me to emphasize on it again, but that whole point that Islam says that your period of za'al, your period of being upset with your fellow mu'min brother, mu'min sister, is 3 days. No more than 3 days. On the third day, and even try before the third day to at least mend ties. You know, minimize the damage. You initiate. Third parties should be involved, etc., etc. The same comes to this. Now, islah dhatul bayn, or reconciling between people who are upset, in most cases, unfortunately, it's not between two people who are foreign to one another, but it's two people who have either lived a long life together or their blood relatives, their family members. And, you know, the worst thing for us to see in a society is for a father not to talk to his son, for a sister not to talk to her brother, for a husband to be in some kind of predicament with his wife, leading to a lot of tension or difficulties in the relationship. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
Thank you.
امام حسین جلو پای امام حسن را نمی رفت.
امام الحسین علیه السلام never overtook امام الحسن علیه السلام when walking with him. This was because of the respect that the younger brother had towards his older one, although Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam was not very much older than his younger brother, Imam al-Husayn. Even when Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam was talking, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam kept silent because of the respect that he had for his older brother and his imam. This is the true manifestation of politeness and favor.
پیغمبر اکرم نشسته، اینو خوب گوش بدید.
Once Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam was giving a sermon in the mosque when a blind man entered the mosque and without knowing that the Prophet was talking, asked him to give some pieces of advice. A person who was sitting close to the Prophet of Allah sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam got upset and turned his face away from the blind man because of his disrespect towards the Prophet. Now, the old man couldn't even see his anger of turning his look away from himself. This was the time when a surah with 10 ayahs was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, condemning this action of the angry man. This surah is called Abbas, starting with the ayah, "He frowned and turned away." Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Exchanging gifts is an inseparable and also the most joyful part of Christmas traditions. How about sharing the joy with animals? Now, a zoo in the Colombian city of Cali is doing so by giving presents to its animals. The presents are actually the animals' favorite foods served in a different way. Animals spend time unpacking the gifts decorated in Christmas theme and then access the food they like the most. Feeding in this way arouses the animals' curiosity and fills them with excitement. Zookeepers say they want to show that animals always receive care at their zoo.
It is a very cool way to generate empathy for visitors. Although animals do not know that it's Christmas or that it's a special date, it is important to generate that message in visitors that we make care of our animals and that for us it is important to share with them this Christmas season.
The zookeepers say they make use of enrichment strategies for their initiative. They actually stimulate the behaviors of a range of animals, even the species they keep in an aquarium. Running a marathon is pretty tough for most, but a group of people has upped the ante to take the competition to sub-zero temperatures of Antarctica. 62 people descended on the Union Glacier from around the world and ran over a 42-kilometer course. The area is just a few hundred kilometers from the South Pole. Soft snow and temperatures as low as minus 15 degrees Celsius did not stop Latvia Evia Rain from setting a women's record. The event was delayed for several days because of a massive storm that battered the area a week ago. Adventurers and athletes have been putting their strength to the test in the race every year since 2005. A tiny baby mouse deer takes its first steps into the world with a round body and spindly legs in a Polish zoo. It was born on December 2nd and now stands roughly 10 centimeters tall. The Warsaw Zoo got its first mouse deer last year and a second one last summer. Zoo staff are surprised that the pair of new arrivals have produced offspring so quickly. Mouse deer are among the smallest mammals. Even as adults, they only weigh around 2 kilograms. Contrary to their name, they are neither from mouse nor from deer species. Some mammalogists consider them living fossils because they haven't evolved much over millennia. Beachgoers in Brazil's Rio de Janeiro have been surprised by very rare visitors, a family of orcas. The family of three was seen swimming in shallow waters of a crowded beach south of the city. The group didn't seem to care at all about the presence of people on their paddleboards. Footage of the orcas quickly spread on social media because they don't usually come that close to the coast. A local biologist says the whales were likely to drawn. They were likely drawn to the area by a cold current from further south.
What we see in the video is a family group that has a male and a female who have a calf. It is common that the orcas come from a colder current where there is also a shoal and they reach the south, the north in fact, and end up hitting our coast. Then they rest in warmer waters such as Copacabana Beach, Ipanema Beach, and Barra da Tijuca.
The biologist says the mammals pose no risk to humans despite the label killer whales. He says there is no record of their attacks on humans. Researchers suspect that the migration patterns of whales could be influenced by climate change and the resulting changes in water temperatures. Serving customers in a high-tech way. That's what a traditional restaurant in the German state of Bavaria does. What's the goal? The owner explains.
We decided ourselves for this robot because of the lack of staff. Looked for support in a technological form. It's not a replacement, of course, but it's a relief for the waiters.
The robot is equipped with a trolley and it can easily move around in the restaurant. When it comes to saving time, the high-tech waiters is of great help, especially when the restaurant is packed with customers. The owner says most customers first become surprised when they come across the robot. He says waiters are still present to serve meals and receive orders. Butterfly gardens are a place where you can watch these tiny creatures and marvel at their beauty. But have you ever wondered where these butterflies come from? These colorful creatures are in fact bred in butterfly farms. And Donald Orsay from Costa Rica is one of the biggest breeders, making that the mission of his life. He produces somewhere around 2,500 pupas per week. Orsay is one of the world's largest exporters of